You're listening to The Lyric Feature on RTE Lyric FM.
On this week's Lyric Feature, we're going to the cold, but not as frozen as it should be, north, where composer and sound recordist Karen Power took part, not for her first time, in the Arctic Circle Scientists and Artists Residency in 2024. This is A Sonic Arctic Return.
Drawn to the place. It was 10 years since I was last there, and it had a big effect on me, and so I was really eager to go back and just experience that environment.
But I was hooked
again.
Actually, as soon as we arrived, there was something which really pulled
me in. Filled with a little bit of dread in that, what was I going to find 10 years later? You know, you read research that indicates there may not be any summer ice.
But this is supposed to be a desert.
Very shortly.
But it's so wet. So it's really experienced.
To me, very strange that it was...
How fundamentally the climate has already changed.
It was raining.
The harshness of it.
At a place that
not real
I'd always understood to be a desert.
It was always, at least for me, so awe-inspiring. And
much moisture.
Just so foreign from my everyday experience.
I don't think it's
so that it doesn't occur, but it feels like
these varying states of stillness.
This is what climate change is, what it looks like, what it sounds like.
Welcome to A Sonic Arctic Return. I'm composer Karen Power, and you've been listening to a few of the voices of artists and scientists who joined me in the summer of 2024 on a return visit to the high Arctic. I'd first visited in 2013, and A Sonic Arctic Return is a sound diary of my return expedition to the Arctic more than a decade after that first visit. On both journeys, I went as part of the Arctic Circle Artistic Residency Expedition, a program that allows researchers time to see, feel, smell, and of course hear this wild, remote, and once frozen desert landscape. As a composer, I spend a lot of my time traveling to remote locations so that I can listen to them undisturbed, so that I can listen and try to understand an ecosystem through its own language, trying to hear what it seeks to communicate. And then to create new work that allows time and space for the other than human to speak. What I wanted from this return to the Arctic was to listen again, to listen to the changes and discover if listening and hearing these changes offers us all a different understanding of this mysterious and isolated place, a place that is rapidly disappearing. As I was sharing this journey with almost 100 others, writers, painters, videographers, sound artists, sculptors, photographers, archaeologists, researchers, and scientists, in some ways, being alone to listen wasn't always easy. But we all understood that it was solely this place, a longing to return to this place that connected us, that made us want to create in and with the Arctic. All of the artists on the expedition got to share the Arctic through their own medium, which for me involved listening and then making field recordings of all of the tiny, large and sometimes hidden sounds which combine to make the Arctic's unique sonic signature. Here I could hear the ceaseless popping of underwater icebergs, the minute trickles of ice melt, the flow of the Arctic wind, the humming of our own transport, and of course the enormous crashing of the glaciers. And then, at times, when the air was still, all you could hear was the soft presence of endless ice. What we're going to listen to now are just some of these recorded sounds, alongside thoughts I recorded in conversation with some of my fellow voyagers, as we collectively listened, looked, and experienced the changes to what was once a floating, frozen desert, which is now melting faster than ever.
I think one of the characteristics as a human being there is that you don't have a sense of scale or time. Those things move into a different kind of dimension. And then we try to locate ourselves within that. And everything feels unstable.
It's like it hits all our senses being there. You know, everything. It's just everything. And it's whenever I focus on one thing, I feel as if I'm missing out on something else.
So that sense of just everything melting and the weight of that was a really overwhelming thing for me.
No way. It's full of life. It's full of changes. It's like every second is something is happening.
One of the things I thought about a lot was the life of the glaciers, partly because of how loud they were to me on this trip, and that I almost felt like they were speaking to me, or that they were communicating something about what they were going through.
For me, the most striking image is you know, freshly calved glacier ice as this unique color, and also big lumps of icebergs that we got really close to. They also had this kind of unique color. In my innocence, I thought that would be really easy to measure now as a scientist, sort of just measure this and put a handle on it. But I found as you got closer to it, it was much more complicated than I first anticipated. As in, you know, you get one of the boats, the Zodiacs, right up to an iceberg, and ice that had just kind of lifted out of the sea was a different color. But in fact, there was a combination of the light that was being transmitted through the water into the ice and reflected back, as well as natural color of the ice.
As an architect trained early on, we learned to construct perspectives. We developed plans, floor plans, and site plans. And I became captivated in the potential to look at the world from eye level and what you see to an aerial view or perspective. Actually, it's the elimination of perspective. Imagine I could look from the top directly down on something. That's a floor plan or a roof plan. And you get a lot of different information than when you look out across at something. And it's possibly the many years I've spent learning that way of seeing the world that made a place for me to connect pretty immediately with flying this unmanned aircraft. That's kind of the captivation of the drone for me. It connects me to the landscape and to the plan view, which for some reason separates us from the perceived view, and I think just describes the world we're literally sitting in a totally different way.
One of our sort of daily meetings at one of the artists, and they were a first timer, did ask Sarah when we were getting to the snow and to the white landscape. You know, and Sarah saying, well, it's summer, so there won't be that. And I think that was what showed me was that they, because it's the Arctic, you know, this particular artist was expecting there to be snow. Yeah, was expecting those sort of landscapes. But of course, that wasn't the case. And I think they were surprised. But that's also the reality now. I think it was the day before we arrived, actually, in Longyearbyen. It was 21 degrees, which is shocking. You know, it was actually warmer than London on that particular day. And that's the hottest, the highest temperature they've ever had there.
The whole place of it being the warmest August on record. And that great melt being, part of the texture of my paper and, the way my pencil would go over the paper if I was outside. Even inside, it was just, everything was a little bit heavy with the melt.
Glaciers will always calve, like it's part of a healthy, a healthy glacier will also do that. But it's I don't know what's common in August, because I've been there in June and July, but I was just the frequency, how nearly commonplace it became to see a calving. It was very sad to see.
Struck me were the waterfalls coming from the the ice shelves and from the glaciers, just the power of them. But yes, I mean, it was constant. We went up a couple of times on the zodiacs where we came relatively close to the waterfalls, and of course there's one time where we came within 3.5 meters of Osfana, the ice shelf, which had the most incredible waterfalls. Of course, the waterfalls is the glacier melting.
Yes, that melt indexing itself on the lens and on the surface, and it was kind of inescapable. When we think about sort of buoying and bouncing around on the zodiacs and trying to record or photograph, and all the water and the moisture in the air affecting our equipment. At the most basic level, even if we're trying to do a watercolor or we're trying to do a drawing with a pen, every time I go through my drawings and and my photographs and my videos, I see these all these little traces of that moisture sort of without my intention entering into how that image is recorded.
Spectacular. But kind of like a double-edged sword, being aware of what's happening in the north and seeing it happening, like all the rain and all the fog and just seeing the glaciers melt in front of our eyes and seeing the dead glaciers and the way the glaciers had receded in a very fast time. Mixed with this awe, there was always this bittersweet notion of changes.
To me, it was the most powerful moment when we spent the whole day in front of a glacier that we couldn't see and we could only listen to it. And I think not seeing it and not seeing its beauty, being blinded by its beauty, having my focus elsewhere, just really listening to it, I was shocked actually by how violent it sounded, that particular glacier. It was calving a lot and there were just these booms reverberating in the bay. And, you know, it sounded like there was like construction noise or demolition going on. Like I could just kind of almost feel these like high rise upon high rise being demolished.
All of those elements of understanding the kind of ground zero for climate change and being in that place and taking that in, that's what it looks like. That it's not like the sun is burning down. It was a very surprising way of realizing, oh, this is also what it can be.
Like it's a time outside of time, if that makes sense. It feels ancient and slow at the same time. And this time, it felt like time and weather, things were accelerated because of global warming and the Anthropocene and the effect that we're having.
It's like the you steps aside. You just feel as big as a pea, and the vastness of this white wild wilderness takes over you. It's almost like your non-existence. You feel just the smallness of the human being, how small we are compared to all this giantness. That and the overwhelming sense that the land is watching you almost.
Everything has been molded by nature and for like a long time, like seeing how the mountains have been kind of stacked up, and you can kind of read the geological eras and the way The ice is shape-shifting. It's like moving all the time. It's never the same. And that's kind of the system of the ice. It kind of has built up and then it gradually disappears. Plus then everything that happens on the shore. There's lots of different kinds of rocks and sand and silt and glacial mud, which you can sink into.
The glacial, the muddy sediments sucking at our boots instead of the deep snow.
So there's so much to observe and so many things in action.
Again, metaphorically, it was almost like quicksand. The snow felt so soft and embracing, and the quicksand, it felt like a danger. And I felt almost an instinctive need to stay away from it when I saw it. Not exactly out of fear, but more something emotional, like I couldn't bear to witness that. I feel the land is changing so fast, and the mud, it felt like the residue of something ancient breaking down again, like the bones of a dying giant melting into the earth. So for me, there was kind of a heaviness and a strangely sad feeling some of the time.
The 24 hours of light is fascinating, remains fascinating to me. You know, kind of gives you a sense of place, because, you know, when you understand why it's 24 hours, you're sort of lifting yourself out of your local situation and seeing, sort of briefly anyway, that, you know, how the Earth is going around the sun and that we're tilted at an angle. So in this summer in the Northern Hemisphere, you know, the sun will never go down. So, you know, I really loved that side of things. And of course, then we were there when the sun dipped below the horizon for the first time. So again, just these things just kind of give you sort of a bigger picture of our place in the solar system, and I suppose to be lofty about the universe.
The light was almost always there, so that sense of time was quite different. And how we measure time and space, I suppose, with the latitudes, was interesting to me. But that the clock meant nothing if the sun was so high that you couldn't really differentiate, you know, day and night. So time was kind of flexible and malleable and changing and stretching.
And as soon as I close my eyes, I'm put back into a sound space that puts me back into that complete space. And that space is very thick with particle movement, with incredible activity that's invisible. So there's this constant layers of activities. There's no stillness. And there's this important, the sound of transformation. And that is, again, an invisible element that we are not privy to, but then when we hear it, that's an incredible sound of transformation. And as I was saying earlier, it is like a chorus of gases and a chorus of deep time, and that is incredible to be immersed in that.
In listening to your sound recording, I had that sense of multiple scales of things very, very near, right beside me, and then things very, very far away. So the crackling and the popping of the air bubbles being very, very close at hand, and then kind of boom, like a calving of a glacier far, far away. The scale, the distances that the sound shapes, I found really fascinating. And visually we saw that, as you say, this place at various scales. Traveling along that the ice shelf for a day, this seemed like this endless ice shelf, but the water, the meltwater pouring off it, just in these streams of waterfalls. You could see that this vast thing was quickly melting, you know? It was that, sort of breathtaking scale. Thinking about this astrophysicist who talks about in space, she says the visible is the portal to the invisible, and I think one might be able to apply that as well to being in a place like the Arctic. The visible is the portal to the invisible, and all of those kinds of, you know, underlying forces that we are now impacting as well within our extraction industries and so on.
The time is different, and you know, In one way, it's all these different layers of time in the landscape, and human time is not the dominant one. I mean, perhaps even deep time or geological time is the dominant one, but there's also, there's glacier time, and there's whale time, and there's polar bear time, and there's tundra time, and there's mythic time. And I thought a lot about these different time concepts, and I've read about the kind of comparison of kind of mythic time and geological time and human time in the work of the Icelandic writer Andri Snær Magnason. And I'm paraphrasing his idea from memory, but I think he writes that now with climate change, geological time has caught up to human time. Like geological time is supposed to be moving so slowly that we can't perceive it, but because of global warming, you know, lots of glaciers are disappearing in the span of a lifetime, and the ocean level is rising. So these are the kinds of events that should take many, many generations to happen, but they happen now in the span of a lifetime. And they're the kind of events that we read about in myths, which means that we're now living in mythological time.
The moisture and the melt is sculpting the landscape differently and rounding it, you know, and that deep blue, my understanding, is due to its ancient ice, its compression. And so it is a kind of another kind of time, another kind of geological time in a way. And if we don't see that deep, deep blue and that ancient time, we see a shorter timeline. And that's frightening. Time is such a huge part of the experience of the Arctic.
Donna Haraway talks about fabulation, right? This kind of making stories in order to kind of be with
something.
We're always going to be in the Anthropocene. Even I think Darwin talked about how, you know, trying to be outside of the Anthropocene to be able to understand something from not from the human view. And so you make a story in order to do that. So it's still coming from the human, but still trying to attempt to be outside of that in some way. Bruno Latour had done a lot of work on climate change and impacts, and he talked about this term called anamorphosis. In order to see it from another perspective, you have to distort it. And I've really taken that to heart, and, you know, that the sense of you need to bring together bird's eye view and aerial views and micro views and macro views to see something from these different perspectives, and when in doing that you distort it, in a sense it does make it into a story, but it is another way of trying to break out of a usual way of seeing something. The climate change in terms of air currents and melting of Greenland or melting in Antarctica, that's so much harder to comprehend. So creating story is, I think, a very powerful engine that way. It can reach people in another way that statistics maybe can't.
Svalbard really brings that home. Like, you know, you can clearly see the retreat of glaciers and how quickly that's happening. But then at the opposite end of the scale, you have how slowly things grow on the tundra, like how incredibly slowly moss and flowers grow, and what a long project that is to cover a little area with vegetation. And the day itself acts weirdly. You know, for most of the year, it's either very bright or very dark, with no sunrise and no sunset. And, you know, someone on another trip that I was on said that the Svalbard year was just one long day followed by one long night.
I mean, there were little worlds in those patches of moss, you know? So many different types of growth, types of mosses, types of lichen. And at such a tiny scale, I loved how those worlds were set like miniature worlds in this big, vast place that we were in.
Things that inform and that shape the Arctic, that lie outside of our sight and outside of our hearing. And maybe when we're in our own places, there's the after effect of things that happen there that become part of our sight and part of our hearing, whether it's storms or extreme weather and so on. But this aspect of invisible forces, I find that such, I mean, that's another compelling aspect of being there, where there a lot of stuff is stripped away and you're there within that kind of a space of invisible forces to concentrate on. And the notion of magnetism itself, or the fact of magnetism being closer to the North Pole, and so how that affects the compass, and that because the magnetic field lines are converging at the pole, so that then the compass needle becomes very erratic, and it tends to point the other way because of being so close. So there's that aspect of invisible forces. There's also gravity, which is stronger closer to the Earth's core, because the Earth kind of bulges at the equator, so the poles bring us close to the Earth's center, and so then that gravity is stronger. And so that aspect, it causes time to slow down. And even though it's a micro slowing down, I felt very aware of that aspect of slowed down time when I was there.
We're living in mythological time, which we haven't done before, the language of the old time isn't sufficient, which you clearly see as well. No amount of articles that people read about rising sea levels and these things that we are so used to reading about now, we don't seem to be able to understand it. But also the language has lost its power, or it's not capturing what's happening. So I think his argument is also that we need a new way of talking about this. Like, we need a new language, or we need to talk about it through stories, and yeah, we need to meet this moment differently.
That was my most memorable day. I would think most people probably feel that way. Well, first of all, going that far north, just having the privilege of being able to go that far north was incredible. And the way that the sea felt like it was breathing, you know, it just, the way the ice was moving with the waves, it was magical. I don't know that I have words for that day. I have drawn and thought about it. Not something I can really describe, but I'm so glad it happened. I don't know that I'll ever in my life experience something that will impact me the way that did.
It's funny because there were a few of us who couldn't stop running outside and taking pictures. It just felt like you couldn't capture it. I took thousands of pictures of the pack ice. We were moving through it, and it was moving relative to each other and to the swell. The water between the pieces, the geometry of the flow is very intriguing to me. But I think in this pack ice, you have individual pieces that have little ponds and pools and different levels of depth. If a piece of ice is eroded in a portion 2 inches, it's covered in 2 inches of water. It's a different color than a portion that's maybe been whirled out to 12 or 15 inches. So these three-dimensional forms revealed by their depth of water, by changing color and interacting with each other, there's a logic to it that we may not recognize or realize. But I thought it was extraordinarily beautiful, intriguing, and I couldn't, there's an insatiability in the trying to capture it. And I'll tell you, there were a couple shipmates who were the same, because I'd see them running out in the middle of someone's talk to capture that. They'd come inside, maybe decided they'd had enough, and then no, they were triggered. And I felt the same way, and I could feel them feeling it, because I was feeling the same thing.
The ice still being fractured that close to the North Pole, for me, there was something unsettling about that. Again, like seeing a sacred body that's no longer whole. I imagined when we were sailing just north, you know, that all caps north, and getting up to the 82nd parallel, I thought there would be an end to the sea and a beginning to the ice, but there wasn't. There was just bits of ice in the sea. And yeah, that sense of it's just in motion. Everything is in the process of breaking and melting and rounding and dripping and cracking. That I found overwhelming.
extreme cold, in the silence in the air itself, and I was out on deck as much as I could humanly handle, soaking in every moment and then quickly going in to warm up and then back out. And what I loved about it was the further we got, the more icy it got, the less people were coming out on board. We were with a very small group that were willing to take the slippery staircase down.
For me, the figure 82 does not really, that's not important. It was more important to be there among the pack ice and see it and experience it.
The 82nd parallel, where there was suddenly much more ice and there was a quite a big swell. And it was extraordinary sort of sight where you could see all the ice sort of in the big swirl. I don't know, I mean, I'm sure you saw it as well. I think it was there for about a few hours where all you could see was most ice, but you could see everything sort of moving.
There was
sort of waves of ice.
Watching over the edge of the boat as we went through the pack ice.
Which I think about half of this day.
We would have been in.
And that's probably the most extraordinary sight I've seen.
If there were no ice.
We were less than 400 kilometers south from the North Pole, at least very close to the North Pole. And then there's just the ice around and the waves. Like looking at the endless ice, just kind of a bit like this danger looming around. Plus then kind of this sadness of like, this is it, and all this is changing, and I'm part of the change.
Bitterly cold wind and ice forming on the deck, you know, it was fascinating, and looking out to see, and seeing pack ice in the sea, maybe as a scientist you realise how extreme the conditions have to be for ice to form and stay in the sea, realise how cold it is. It's just an extreme environment. It was amazing that life did exist up there.
I love those fulmars. They're called seahorse or ocean horse in Norwegian. And just a constant source of fascination in the Arctic, how these birds survive in that environment. They look really tough, the fulmars or the seahorses, with their kind of flat face. And they're such excellent flyers.
Being up there, even though we're with other people, there was something very lonely about that. And in the sense that at any time we could just kind of dissolve into the ocean waves, just like the ice pack itself. Kinship that we have with other forces, because we're also an energy, we're also a force within larger energies. It's just wonderful to realize that and to see it. Maybe part of our work as artists is to also be able to visualize that and communicate that in different ways.
You know what I love is Barry Lopez. The highest variety of species is at the equator, and the fewest number of each. And the further toward the poles you go, the fewer species diversity you have, and the larger number of each, based on the harsh environment. Large herds can be more resilient to catastrophic impacts of weather or changes in food availability and that kind of thing. So I always think, when we're at that pole, how few species there are. But I wonder, are there still thousands per variety? When Barry Lopez wrote that, that was decades ago.
The polar bears always makes me feel like I shouldn't be there. And I mean, a part of me feels like that no one should be there. And I know that's never going to happen, but that we should just retreat and let nature be nature without our influence. I know that, for instance, even though we stay away from the polar bears when we see them, a few approached on that trip, approached a ship and got very close to us, which is a sign that they are becoming more accustomed to humans. Like, they are learning that humans aren't dangerous in Svalbard. And while that's wonderful for tourists like us to get so close to them in a safe setting, like being on the ship, you know, what is that doing to the safety of the polar bears? Because the more used to humans they get, the more dangerous situations they're in.
There's a sound we can hear and perceive. There's so much sound waves out there that, as humans, we're not perceiving, you know, whales and sea lions emit sounds in the water. And there's other higher and lower frequencies, even from above ground, that we're not able to perceive, but perhaps animals and birds can.
Was a walrus. I've never been so close to a large group of walruses before, and the smell was unbelievable.
At some places you could see like these tiniest little plants and even trees that are like 2 centimeters tall, like the willow, the tiny willows. It's really mind-blowing that even in very harsh conditions there is so much vegetation.
Being part of the sound zodiacs, the kind of the absolute silence zodiacs, as I think they were called, was probably my favorite part of the expedition. I'm not a sound artist, so I didn't really have a reason to be there. It was my favorite thing for a few different reasons. One was that it just opened up this new way of experiencing the landscape, and that we had to sit so still that, you know, I couldn't really move when I was in the zodiac. So I wasn't chasing the best viewpoint or you know, trying to take a photo, or I just had to sit still and be, which is very rare. And then, of course, there was so much focus on the sound, and I wasn't able to listen to at the time the sound underneath the water, but still the sound became such a huge part of my experience, in a way that I think we mostly prioritize sight. And some of these zodiacs were in the fog, so there was just sound. But also being in the company of people recording sound made me, I hope, a better listener. And another thing that I really loved it was that I really loved the expedition and met so many wonderful people, but it was very noisy on the ship. We were 100 artists together on a ship. And for me to try to kind of experience the landscape or see the landscape or connect to the landscape, I found that very hard to do with dozens of people around me. So I appreciated just the silence and the time to just sit and experience. And another thing that was really beautiful that happened was that the people in the zodiac were some of the people that I felt the strongest connection to on the ship, but we didn't speak when we were in the zodiacs. So there was this community that was created in silence. It was a kind of silent community or solitary community that I really appreciated being part of.
It does need help, and it does need to be communicated in ways that actually go beyond how it's packaged as a tourist destination. It needs artists to record it and depict it and reframe it and direct attention in a way that speaks to its precarious beauty.
A Sonic Arctic Return was presented by Karen Power and some of the other participants in the Arctic Circle Expeditionary Residence in 2024. They included visual artists Laura Millard, Ingrid Koenig, Pat Naldi, Kaisu Koivisto, Bonnie Leventhal and Patricia Ramir, as well as physicist Tom McCormack, multidisciplinary practitioner Katie O'Meara and writer Cinna Borgen. The programme was produced by Karen Power and Luke Clancy and was a Sounds Doable production for The Lyric Feature. For more information on the residency, visit thearcticcircle.org.
The series producer is Owen O'Kelly and the production coordinator is Michael O'Kane.
The Lyric Feature is available to listen to or to podcast from various well-known podcast platforms and also from the RTE radio app and, of course, The Lyric Feature's own webpage, which you'll find on the RTE website. You can contact the programme with your comments or observations, features.lyricfm@rte.ie. Next week on The Lyric Feature, without its reeds, the Illan Pipes make no music, but the reeds themselves are fickle creatures, true and tuneful for a time, until giving up entirely, sometimes without prior warning. It's a fate that pipers Paddy Benson and Grace Lemon are familiar with and are itching to explore with other pipers. Dead Reeds is The Lyric Feature next Sunday at 6 p.m.